Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish reading the book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for you lovely listeners to check out. Now, a bit of news since the last time. I made some notes here. Let's open the notes. Yes, first of all, my NaNoWriMo novel, my National Novel Writing Month novel that I started working back in August. I finally passed 50,000 words 16 days after the end of November, but it's pretty good. I've got one chapter to go, well, probably less than a chapter. I've got one section of one chapter to write, about 1,000 words to write it, and the rest of the book is completely finished written, it's completely edited, but this last 1,000 words, for some reason, I'm just stuck, and I just can't get into it at all, and it's really messing up my mind of actually what I need to portray in this thing and exactly what's going to happen and which characters are going to say what, which is a bit strange because it is like the first half of the second last chapter of the book, and I should have really worked that out a lot better. Well, it has been worked out, but as I've been writing the rest of the book and I've been going back and editing it and everything like that, so everything's written, everything's edited, it's just this one section was really sticking with me. So I thought, well, hey, what I'll do is I finished the book that the last book I was reading, and so I might as well just do that review. So I've taken a bit of time to write some notes of the review here. One other thing is that just this afternoon I listened to the latest episode of the SFF audio podcast, episode 44, if you're listening to this in the future. Now, I know I've talked about these guys quite a bit, Jesse and Scott, they're at sffaudio.com, I think it's his. You can find it there, SFF audio podcast. But this time they were joined by, I've just copy-pasted the description here. Jesse and Scott are joined by Professor Eric S. Rabkin of the University of Michigan to discuss fairy tales, fantastic science fiction, etc. like that. And it's really good. Jesse mentioned this guy before, and I listened to one of his lectures on the time machine. He sent me that over, and I thought that was really, really good. But this discussion on this episode is probably one of the most interesting hour-long discussions of science fiction I've heard in a long time. So I do recommend you checking that out. And after listening to that, I was thinking, okay, that inspires me to do some literary criticism of my own for today. And today's book is Neal Stephenson's Anathem. Like I say, it's a big chunky book. This is the sound of it landing on the desk beside my bed. Landing on top of it. Maybe it didn't sound very good. But there it is anyway. And yes, it's published in 2008, last year, I guess. It was a big book last year, one of the bestsellers, it says on the front here, number one New York Times bestseller, but it's a chunky book, 981 pages. I can't help but think how many people actually bought the book and didn't read it through all to the end. A bit of a strange thing, this story of why I'm reading this, mainly one of the reasons was because when I was in Miami Airport, I was in Borders, and there wasn't a huge selection of science fiction books, and it was either this book and most of the other science fiction books I'd either read or just wasn't interested in at all. So it was either this book or The Code, the Something Protocol by Tobias S. Buckel, but that was a franchise book set in the Halo universe, and I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to try that out. So I thought I'd try out another Neal Stephenson book. Now, it's a big book, so I knew it would take a while for me to read, but I've got 4 weeks on this cruise ship. That's longer than I normally spend on a cruise ship. A lot of sea days, a lot of places I've been to before, had visited before, so I knew I'd have time and the inspiration to read this. The thing is, I'd heard many opinions about this book. Lots of people saying, oh, it's really long, oh, it's really boring, oh, no, there's too many made-up words. Now, I don't mind any of that about the book, but a lot of people were saying, oh, I love Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson, another Neal Stephenson's other science fiction book, but I really hated Anathem, and I was like, hey, well, I absolutely hated Snow Crash, so this book might be the book for me. So what I did, actually, after I finished the book a few days ago, but today, in preparation, because I knew I'd be doing this review, I thought I'd do an experiment and look up and check the one-star reviews on Amazon.com of this book. And as I say, I don't normally check reviews, other people's reviews, before I do a review of my own, but like I say, just because of this. So out of the 10 on the front page of the one-star reviews, that they all open with lines like this. Don't get me wrong, I love Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age, Cryptonomicon, Snow Crash. And then, of course, the big implied but. Oh, and the next one was like, I love Snow Crash and appreciate the amount of detail he added into it, but this book had too much detail. It's like, I'm a big Stevenson fan, but, you know, I'm a long-time sci-fi reader and found some of his early novels to be insightful, imaginative, and actually good stories. But. Neil Stephenson, they actually wrote it down long, I copied and pasted his here. Neil Stephenson, didn't even get the name of the author right, is my favourite novelist, but this book is unreadable. I enjoyed Stevenson's Baroque Cycle as well as Cryptonomicon. Snow Crash was, how can I put it, repulsive. Oh, I actually agree with that one. He says, as a fan of Stevenson's other works, I was excited to look forward to digging into this one. And finally he goes, I'm a fan of Stevenson's previous works before Baroque Cycle, so in other words, Snow Crash and all those ones. So it was actually quite interesting to seeing, okay, that's the kind of people who loved Snow Crash and hated this book, and I thought, well, maybe I'm going to be the opposite of this, because a lot of these people are saying, hey, I'm a big fan of Stevenson's, that's the big thing, I'm a big Stevenson fan, I'm a fan of Stevenson's. The thing is, I don't actually consider myself a big fan of any author. I enjoy reading some novelists, of course, a lot more than others, but I do think that every great writer has a real stinker of a novel in them, and then every bad writer has probably got one novel that's worth reading, which, with that in mind, is the reason why, first of all, even if I read a book that I don't like, which I've by a new author, say it's the first book by an author I've read and I really dislike it, I'll always give them a second chance. That's why, you know, I hated Red Thunder by what's his name? Can't remember his name now, John Varley. But I really, when I picked up Steel Beach, people recommended that. I really enjoyed it, and that's happened time and time again, especially just even within this podcast. And also, with that in mind, I never actually take a novel on the strength of the previous work by the same author. I always review the novel I have in front of me, not influenced really too much by a previous novel. So I'm going to see if I can review this without actually mentioning how much I disliked and any of the things that I disliked in Snow Crash, because that was a whole podcast and a half in its own right. And I'll just stick with this novel here. As you may have got the hint, I did actually quite enjoy it. Okay, I just did something which I've very, 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 very rarely do. Actually, probably the first time I've ever done this, in the whole past year of doing this podcast, I decided to stop recording and go back and do a retake of something, because I realised I just got about 4 or 5 minutes into talking about the world of the book and forgot to mention a really, really important fact, and then tried to go back and rectify that. I'm redoing this bit because I know I'm probably going to talk long enough about this book already without having to do really messy explanations. So let's go straight into it. The world, we're set on a world which is not Earth at all, but it's very much like Earth, but not Earth. Now, I've read this, I've had this same kind of thing explained at the beginning, you know, like in the introduction to the book. It says here, it says, if you're accustomed to reading works of speculative fiction and enjoy puzzling things out on your own, skip this note. Otherwise, know that the scene in this book is set on, not on Earth, but a planet called Arbre, which is similar to the Earth in many ways. So actually, once I'd read that one, I thought, okay, well, I'm accustomed to reading works of speculative fiction, so I skipped it. But that kind of note at the beginning of the book is sometimes goes, it makes me think, oh no, wait a second, because, you know, there was the Nightfall book, which I reviewed and really didn't enjoy the novel-length version of that story at all. And that's the same kind of thing. It's like, yeah, it's like Earth, but it's not Earth because it's got more suns, but it's sort of like, in a way, for us to be a little bit, you know, lazy with the writing. We don't have to come up with new technologies. We don't have to think things through. We'll just say, well, it's like Earth, and everyone's pretty much like humans, even though the sun never goes down. It's like, well, that means there'd be a massive difference in human society if the sun never goes down. Everything would be different. It's like, yeah, but we'll just say it's like Earth, but different. So that means we don't have to think all that through. We don't have to do all of that kind of stuff. So that's what I was thinking, maybe going into this book, and I was like groaning a bit. But actually, there's none of that at all here. He says this for good reason going into the book, and all the terminology that he uses, Neil Stephenson uses, and he comes up with lots of new terms, it does actually make a lot of sense and makes for a much richer world and a much more real world, even though it is not Earth and it is different. There's reasons for what he's doing there, and it pays off very well. Like, immediately it pays off very well just in the actual world-building exercise, but later on when he gets more into, like, the thematic things and more into the deeper into the plot and into the construction of the world, it makes a lot of sense later on, which I don't want to go too much into that because it'll spoil it maybe. So anyway, we're talking about Arb, which actually I just glanced down at the next paragraph in the introduction. It says it's pronounced Arb, so let's call it Arb. And what you have is you've got about 7,000 years of history. Now, parts of this history, the ancient history, say about the first 3,500 years of this ancient history, parallels quite closely what we have here on Earth. You've got very early philosophers and mathematicians, and you've got a golden age of philosophy and maths as well, which is, seems to very much reflect like ancient Greek culture here on Earth. And you've got sort of like you got Protas, who's a philosopher, and Thelonis, which is a philosopher, and then you go on and you get foundations of religion and a much bigger, well, let me say this, you know, they call it there's the rebirth and the opening of the books and the dispersal of the mathic system. So you've got like the Renaissance and, you know, after the Dark Age of Renaissance. And what actually happens is that everyone becomes, there's lots more technology. And then what happens is it goes through this, these few big events, and it comes to this thing called the terrible events. And the terrible events is capitalized, and the world is plunged into darkness, and nobody's quite sure what's gone on there, and all records are lost, and everything goes really badly. So what happens then? This is, again, 3,500 years in the past of the events that are set here in this in the Book of Anathem. So what happens is that to stop this kind of thing happening again, to stop like the technology overrunning and everyone becoming too powerful with technology, they get all the intellectuals, and all the intellectuals retreat into things called maths or consents, which is a bit like a convent. Well, not so much like a convent, it's more like a monastery, and the intellectuals and the mathematicians and the scientists and everything, they get on with their own thing inside these monasteries, and the doors or the gates are only opened once a year for sort of like yearly students to come in, and then another gate is opened once every 10 years to sort of like longer term students. So another gate only opens every 100 years, and that's the real deep thinkers. Then they can go out into the wider world and spread their things. And the biggest, deepest thinkers, the ones that would have the most profound effect, who are coming up with the ideas that have the most profound effect, their gate only opens once every 1,000 years. So only once every 1,000 years is there sort of like a big sort of surge of really huge ideas. But by that time, the other ideas are coming out. They're trickling out of these the maths, the consents very slowly. And so the secular powers are the secular people on the outside of the walls, what they call the extramuros, the people who live outside of the walls of these intellectual monasteries. They can get on with their own lives without too much trouble. However, what happens is that every time that the secular powers, the powers that be outside of the walls, every time they get into a sticky situation, they can call on the people, like the people inside the monasteries, inside the consents. They call them the avowed, which I guess is a play on the word devout, but the opposite of devout, they're avowed, I guess, maybe, I'm not sure. And so, you know, when they need help, they call in and say, hey, we need some help with this situation or with that situation, or we need you to help with this, or we need you to organize this for us. And so they take they take one or two of these intellectual monks outside of the consents and to get them to help out. So that's the kind of thing that's set there. Oh, also, there's if a big event happens, what they do, they can have these big sort of gatherings where they don't just bring one or two people out, one or two intellectual experts out of these consents. They can bring as many people as they want out as well. That doesn't happen very often. Only once in the history of the last 3,500 years of this situation, and also once every few thousand years as well, the secular powers, they look at the mass and they're going, okay, they're too powerful, or they release some new technology or some new mode of thought, or something comes out of the maths which is too dangerous, and they sack them and they kill everyone inside, and the few people that are left over, the few of the avowed who are left over, sort of restart the system again with a new set of rules and keep going on to it. But each time that happens, they focus less on the praxis, which is the technical technology kind of based stuff, and they go more into the theorics, which is more the theoretical and the pure maths side of things, and the cosmology kind of things rather than the technology kind of things. So it's a bit strange. So what you have here really is a situation, it felt for me a little bit like, you know, the Canticle for Leibowitz situation there, but in this book the monks actually hold on to useful knowledge and hold things which is actually significant rather than religious relics and religious thought and stuff like that. They're actually willing to share it, and they're useful rather than unlike the monks in the monasteries in the Canticle for Leibowitz, which don't seem to have any use except for, oh, we're keeping stuff safe. Oh, are you? Yeah, we are. What are you keeping safe? This bit of wood. Thanks. Great. So anyway, like I say, all this has been in place for about 3,000 years, and because of this, after the terrible events, because of the sort of like the dual power structure in the world, the secular power, and then the maths themselves, the constants themselves, there's a balance there, and they balance each other out. So civilization, or the world, has become much more of a stable place. So civilizations rise and falls, but they do so gradually and kindly, and powers come and go, and knowledge outside grows and shrinks, and the world is very well trod outside of the walls of the worlds of these monasteries. And that's very well reflected in the novel, because you actually get sort of like this massive history. You can really feel this massive history inside the walls of these monasteries. But also you can feel, like you say, the long history on the outside as well, which is actually really interesting. Just before, actually, I was talking, as I'd started, got maybe about 100 pages into this book, and when I was back in Buenos Aires, I was talking on Skype to Jesse. And actually, I've got quite a bit of good feedback from the conversation, or the Jesse and Luke in Conversation podcast episode that I dropped in there. So maybe in the future, when I get back to Berlin, I'll do that maybe again. Maybe not just with Jesse, but some other people. I'll just drop some conversations, because you can bring it in dialogue. You can bring out a lot more things than just one person talking by himself, which is slightly the theme of this book. Anyway, so we're talking about it, and we're talking about the Jared Diamond, who's written some interesting books about history and the history of civilization and growing and technology and things like that. And I read the book called Collapse. Jesse had read a different one, and that was on my mind. Actually, I was thinking about that kind of stuff as I was then reading some of the passages in this book over the last few weeks as I've been reading it, and it seems like that kind of thought has been put into it. Now, that's a whole book just about why societies collapse, but yet in this book, because it's such a chunky book, you've got like 1,000 pages to play with. You can get those big ideas into this novel about whole societies rising and growing and then shrinking and collapsing, and the remains that they leave behind, and where the energy goes and where it comes from, and climate change and all these different kind of things. It can all fit in there. So the world building, like I say, in this thing, I can't even go into too much detail about it. I think I'm going to some pertinent points here, but because you've got like 1,000 pages, almost 1,000 pages, you've got a lot to play with. As I said, it really does rival a work like The Lord of the Rings or the Dune universe, you know, where they've got thousands of pages to work with to sort of grow their societies and to give them massive histories and stuff like that. And when I was making the notes, I was trying to think of another book or another series of books which does have like the massive history that, say, The Lord of the Rings and Dune does, but I couldn't think of anything off the top of my head. So a book like Anathem, that it stands equal, I would say, to the history and the worlds of those two great examples of fantasy and science fiction. I like I say, it doesn't happen that often, and this does stand shoulder to shoulder with those, I think. Maybe if I think about it more, it wouldn't do. I'm not sure. But then, what really makes it very impressive, even if you just take it on like this superficial, oh, it's an interesting world and things like that, in the book, Two of the characters, they have this conversation. One of the technological experts from the ITA, or the ITA, I'm not quite sure the pronunciation, but the technology people who help out the Avowed, they have this conversation, and someone says, it happens at a very low level. And one of the other people says, but I know that when you talk about low level, you actually mean something very, very important. And the lower the level you get in a system, say in a computer system, the more important it is. So if something messes up on a higher level, which is like a higher level in the processing chain, it means you've done a spelling error or something like that. But if something goes wrong with a flip flop or a bit or something like that, right down at the very bottom, it's much more important. Now, a lot of books that I've read, like I say, Nightfall, by Robert Silverberg and Isaac Asimov, where they've taken a world and then they've just sort of pasted something on, but a sort of a like a at a very conceptual level, but somewhere that like not a very low level, not a very in like underlying level. They've just gone, okay, somewhere like Earth, but with more suns, and you're like, okay. And it's very unsatisfying when you do that. Now, what Neal Stephenson has done here in this book has taken it down to the world building, back down to such first principles. He's actually gone, okay, what is the quantum level of energy that the electron circles around the nucleus in an atom? Maybe I'm getting the terms mixed up here or something like that, but he's gone, okay, what is that relationship, and what is that level there, and how big is the quantum, what is it, the Planck constant? You know, that's the kind of level that he's gone down to. You go, okay, now building up from that, taking that into consideration, let me build a world from there. Now, it's not a purely original world, because it does, like I say, there are reflections from the human world, the actual Earth world, our own universe, in a way, if you put it that way. But even that is tied into the world building and tied into the plot and stuff like that. So when I'm thinking about this kind of thing, that he's built a world from the subatomic level, plus from that up into the world that we see in the book, plus to fill it with 7,000 years of history, is, like I say, it's just an amazing thing, you know. But also, these two things isn't just world building. For example, like I say, that kind of like, okay, what is the Planck length? If talking about it that way, what is the Planck length in this universe? And then later on, it becomes, you know, it comes into world building. And then later on, of course, it becomes like, it goes for an interesting interaction between the characters. And then later on, it becomes an actual interesting plot point, like a crucial plot point later on in the novel. And that, I find, is quite an amazing accomplishment here, and is quite mind-blowing on many levels, actually, how deep the world building goes and actually how much it informs the story and how many levels it plays into it, not just in a plot way but also in a thematic way as well. Anyway, moving on to the plot now, and that's me missing out most of the world building. I just went over tiny little bits there, but let's just move straight onto the plot, because otherwise I could do like an hour-long podcast on each of these features, I think, under a book like this. Anyway, the plot. Now, categorizing the plot, so instead of actually me going through it, but to categorize it, it is a first contact book. If we're going to go for subgenre of science fiction, I'd call it first contact. But there's a few different ways of this has been approached over the years. Of course, you got like alien invasion, dum dum dum, you know, where they come down and they do it. Another time is sort of like big dumb object floats by, you know, and that's an interesting way as well. You've got like the people coming in from outer space, but they're hidden and nobody's quite sure that they've arrived yet. But they're orbiting around Earth and stuff like that. So there's sort of like the hidden aliens, and you've got the hidden aliens among us, and all these different kind of different approaches to the first contact novel. What I really enjoyed about Anathem is that that Neal Stephenson has pretty much gone, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take all these ideas and I'm going to combine them, not all of them, but I'm going to take various different first contact ideas and I'm going to combine them all into one book. So we've got, it's a first contact novel, but then there's so many other different kind of novels in here, or different takes on it as well. So he could spend, because it's such a long novel, he can spend 200 pages just working out that it is a first contact novel, that there are actually aliens out there, and that the humans, that the people on this world have discovered that they're there in the first place. But that point, or that part of the book, isn't wasted, but that could have been a whole novel just in its own right, to the discovery of the aliens above us. And then you've got the whole, okay, well, they're above us and now we've got to communicate with them, and which is normally a whole other kind of section of a first contact book, like say Carl Sagan's Contact. It's all about, okay, they're there and we've got this message and we have to decode it and we've got to send a message back or do something like that, and that's that whole novel. And of course, that kind of thing happens as well in this book. And then you've got the whole, okay, but there's aliens up there, but what are we going to do about them? Are they good or are they bad? And then you've got like, okay, what are we, you know, and there's all these different things. So I'm going to break this book down into these different sections. For example, like I say, the first 250 pages are set entirely... or exclusively, well, I wouldn't say that because they do actually throw the gates open at one point. But it's all set in the math, with where the main character is living. And this whole book is actually this whole first novel within a novel is actually a really good mystery novel. I've read a lot of complaints and criticisms, or I've heard a lot of complaints about this. People say, oh, nothing happens for the first 200 pages. It's like it takes 200 pages for the plot to begin. And I'm thinking, did we read the same novel here? The first 200 pages is, like, you've got loads of world building in, but there's this whole great mystery going on. And, of course, I've sort of slightly spoiled it. What the answer to the mystery is that, yes, okay, the answer to the mystery is, like, okay, there's aliens above us. But there's loads of cute clues and red herrings and subterfuge and the way that they discover it and the way that they work it out and the technology and everything, the world behind it and everything, that the whole groundwork that's laid for the rest of the novel and philosophy-wise and technology-wise and thematically-wise and everything like that is being laid down in these first 250 pages. So even if there was absolutely no plot at all in the first 250 pages, it would still have a great function. But there is plot there. There's actually almost a self-contained novel right there in the first 250 pages, and I really, really enjoyed it. A lot of people say, oh, nothing happens, they're just wandering around. I'm like, we'll put it this way. One of my favorite non-science fiction, oh, let me put it this way. One of my favorite historical novels is Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose. And I'm thinking, of course, Neal Stephenson must have read that book, or, you know, I mean, there's no way he couldn't have not read that book when you're actually reading his first thing, because, you know, he takes in that book like 3, 4, 5 pages to describe a doorway, and then another 20 pages to describe, like, the layout of a single floor, and then another 40 pages to describe how the library is catalogued, and all these different kind of things, and you're thinking, wow, I mean, but that's a big chunky book. That's probably around about, off the top of my head, probably around about 700, 800 pages just there. But we sort of get like a whole Name of the Rose in the first 200 pages of this book. And I really, really enjoyed it. Now, the next 300 pages of Anathem, the next like novel that we have, is like the main character and some others leaves this, leaves their math, leaves their monastery, if you will. And he goes on a quest. And this quest is very much like, again, from another book that I've reviewed recently, enjoyed, say, The Left Hand of Darkness, where you've got one guy going out into the world. Now, of course, planetary romance is very much, well, is often set, okay, with sort of like one guy alone by himself on an alien planet. Now, that's not quite what we have in this book, but if you've lived 10 years of your life, all of your growing up years have taken place in a monastery, completely and utterly secluded from the rest of the world. You going out and then exploring that world is very much a planetary romance. So he's a foreigner traveling across a country that he doesn't understand, and he goes on an interesting journey and meets interesting people and goes on adventures and has adventures, stuff like that. So you've even, like the Left Hand of Darkness, you've even got a crossing of an ice cap as well in there going on, which I found quite interesting, and the problems that you face there, and he's got to get from one place to the other. There's lots of other stuff going on here at this point as well, throughout these sections, you know, lots more world building. You know, we've had 250 pages of world building inside the monasteries, and then you've got 250 pages of world building outside of the monastery as well, in the secular world, the extramuros world, and then you get to understand what's going on there, a little bit more about the politics on the outside, and you get to care about not just the people inside these consents, but also the people on the outside of the consents, the seculars, not just the theorics, not just the intellectuals on the inside as well. So that's good. And there's lots of action and there's lots of adventure and stuff like that. The next about 250 pages, move on to much more. The pace slows down again here, and they go back into another consent. Again, I'm not giving away too much of the plot here because, you know, there's loads of other stuff going on that I don't want to talk about. But at this point, you go, okay, he's like, okay, now let's reflect on everything we've learned so far. Let's look at the world that we've done so far. Let's tease out some more bits and pieces of the political maneuvering. Let's tease out these theories. Let's tease out these different bits and pieces going on here. And let's work out actually what's going on. Let's fill in the answers. Now, I will refer back to Snow Crash at this point and say this was actually when he was talking about all the different theories of the minds and the mind viruses in that book, one of my least favourite parts of the book, because unlike this book, which is, it's all about the dialogues. It's all about the, I was going to say Socratic dialogues, but it's not just about one person asking questions of the other, although that does happen a lot. But it's all about the... It's all about the philosophical dialogues that are going on here between two either interested parties, one person asking questions the other, or, you know, they actually have some names. Let me flick to the glossary of the back here because I know it'll be in here. Let me look up dialogues. Let me see if I can find this here in the glossary, because I think this is quite important for this book. So you've got the dialogues, you've got the Savinian dialogue, you've got the triangular dialogue, the Periclinian dialogue, the Peregrine dialogue, and there's these different ways of talking to each other and gaining knowledge and different things, and you get examples of that certainly in these 200 pages here of all of these different kinds of discourses, these different dialogues. And it's important that it's a dialogue. It's one person knowing something, another person knowing something else, and then bashing out something between them, or something like that, or one person learning something, or one person defeating someone. It's very interesting. Now, in Snow Crash, you didn't have a dialogue. You had the librarian just pretty much lecturing hero protagonist. Sort of makes me grimace just to remember these sections of the book and Snow Crash in its entirety there. But you don't even have that. You just have one person lecturing somebody else and them going, oh yeah, that would work out. You had knowledge ready there on a plate being presented to another character and being presented to you. But you didn't have to think about it anyway. It was just answers being given. And then later on in Snow Crash, hero protagonist does the same thing. He just then lays out the whole plot and the whole answers and all the whole theory to another set of people later on in the book. But here, it's constructed a lot more interestingly than that. There's a lot more stuff going on. There's a lot more... it's just there's more of a dialogue there, and it's actually something interesting, and you're working stuff out for yourself and as the reader, and you've really got to think about it because there's complex stuff going on. There's real mind-bending stuff. At the same time, the plot does move forward. We do find about the secular and the mathic response to the alien spacecraft above. You do get a little bit of big dumb object kind of stuff going on there as well, where they're trying to look at it and trying to investigate what's actually above them and try and see it for what it is, which is good. But by the end of this, by about maybe 200 pages before the end of the novel, we know all the answers, we know everything that's happening, and we've got a view of the world. We've actually managed to establish the, like I say, from the history of the world up until this point, but also the technology and the science and the philosophy of the world up until this point as well. And we've got to this final thing. And I was actually thinking at this point in the book, where do we go from here? We've had like three distinct sections here of about 250 pages each, you know, roughly 250 pages each, of three completely different kinds of novel, three different, completely different kinds of world building, of exposition, of even, you know, motion or travel, or, you know, a sense of journey as well. I thought, what's going to happen here? And then what you do is in the last 150 pages, to my complete surprise, we just have a pure spaceships and laser kind of almost... what we're trying to say. Yeah, it's sort of like just a big sort of science fiction, not quite space opera, but it is almost space opera thing going on as well. And because also the protagonist, Erasmus, is a young, he's like young and first person, and he's going into space. I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, it is science fiction, and this is a section of the end. It's a very, very Heinleinian, you know. You could almost take passages out of the end of this book and transplant them directly into, say, Starship Troopers or Space Cadet. That's one that came to mind. And of course, like his other juvenile novels as well, like Have Spaceship Will Travel, Have Spacesuit Will Travel, which I've mentioned a number of times in my podcast as well. But it's literally just like that. And yet at the same time, it doesn't quite follow that path to the very end, because I'm thinking, okay, we've had 900 pages and only one person has died. And that's amazing. For me, that is amazing. And I'm thinking, how can I believe any of the main characters are in danger now? They're literally going on to take on the aliens in space. They're going up into space. And I'm thinking, but then within the framework of a golden age science fiction, spaceships and lasers kind of romp, it ties in really nicely with some interesting twists and turns back into all of the themes that have been explored so far in the book. And my mind was a tiny bit blown one more time after it being blown independently 3 or 4 or 5 times, distinct times throughout the book so far, that it gets to the end and I'm just like, that actually was really, really clever. Now, while it was really clever on an intellectual level, from a storytelling point of view, plot-wise, the end, to be honest, wasn't as satisfying as it could be. Because, you know, I was never quite sure about the true motivations of the aliens and stuff like that. And the pacing was a little bit long at some points. Like, some points it's like, bish, bash, bosh, big events. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. You've just spent 40 pages talking about this one book in a library. Well, I'm not, you know, I'm just taking it to the extreme there. And then it's sort of like this massive world-changing event happens, and then you just skip forward and then have some had-hads to fill us in a bit. But then, you know, and it talks about this, but I thought, wait a second, that was a major event in this, in our protagonist's life, and I wasn't quite, never quite sure if, again, if it was like, if it was bad writing or bad plotting or unreliable narrator or what actually was going on there. So, but again, even that, even the unsatisfying plot tied back into the thematic and the other things that were going on in the book in such a way that was very, very clever, even if it wasn't satisfying on a plot level, but it was satisfying on an intellectual level. But then you're always thinking, and this is why I say go and listen to the SFF audio podcast episode 44, because they asked the question of a professional literature professor. Let me put it this way, who actually teaches this kind of stuff, and they say, well, how much is it intentional? How much of it written in the book is intentional, and how much of it is just the reader putting on to the author what he thinks the author meant? And in this way, I'm just thinking there's so much going on in this book, you know, theoretically, well, not theoretically, philosophically, and everything else going on in this book, that I can't even begin to think that I know more about this text than Neal Stephenson as he was writing it. I mean, he's got so much in here that I can't even think that. I mean, there's so many references that I obviously don't get. There's a lot of references that, of course, do get. But there's so many references that I don't get. I'm thinking, what level is he doing this intentionally? And what level is it that, you know, I know because he wrote Snow Crash that maybe he doesn't have everything in his fiction under control. How much of it is there? But then listening to this podcast let me just flick up in my notes and find the guy again, Professor Eric S. Rabkin, and the way that he approaches it, he's saying, well, that isn't the question. And sometimes, and he gave this great story that I really do think you should listen to, about saying that sometimes the author doesn't know that. And I've actually come across it once or twice in my own within my own fiction, that my own novel that I released, Mining Tomorrow. People have written back to me and say, oh, it was so great that this bit and this bit really tie in together. And I look at it and go, yeah, that is true. And I didn't even notice it when I was writing it, but there is actually a very clear link there between two events that I didn't come up with in my mind. But when someone pointed it out to me, I was like, yeah, of course, that makes sense. And I wrote it, and I didn't understand what I was writing. But there's other things in the novel, like, for example, that someone said, what about this? There's these two things in there, and they're linked together. And that's actually the thing. The thing was, there's only two events. There's only two things, acts of violence. There's only two acts of violence or aggression in the entirety of my first novel. And neither of them are explained. And that was actually something I put in there quite specifically. One is to foreshadow the other, that something happens, you're like, whoa, what just happened then? It wasn't explained. And then something bigger happens later on. You're like, whoa, what happened then? It isn't explained. And then it, you know, it is, one thing was meant to be a lead into another. And actually someone wrote to me and picked up on that. And I was like, ha. Full marks. I'm not sure if they had picked up on it exactly, but I explained it to them and they're like, oh, that's very interesting. I was like, that's great, because I actually put that in there intentionally. But there's some other things that people have written to me about which are as interesting and as profound, well, not even profound, but as, you know, relevant to the story thematically and otherwise, that it actually that I never even knew it was in there. So that's what I'm saying. It's you get that kind of thing. Anyway, I went off on a tangent, but I wasn't quite sure. Oh yeah, plot-wise, not quite sure how much that actually relies on thematics. And I haven't even really gone too much of the themes here. I'll get into that later. Characters. What do? We follow the story of, first of all, actually, I just talked to, it's a first-person narrative written by the protagonist, whose name is main character.
No. His name
is Erasmus, and he's quite likable, not very interesting. He's not too clever. But then again, that isn't really his role in the book. At one point, let me just flick back to the glossary again. I should have saved my place here, because I was gonna bring this up here when I was talking about the dialogues before. The triangular dialogue, let me put it this way. We have triangular dialogues features a savant, an ordinary person who seeks knowledge, and an imbecile. Now, in this book, we are the ordinary person seeking knowledge. Neal Stephenson is, of course, the savant. And the imbecile is, as far as I can tell, Erasmus, our main character, because he doesn't really understand stuff. He doesn't really grasp stuff. There's a lot of stuff happening around him. He's never quite sure what's going on. But by following what the imbecile is doing, we really get a clear idea. Us as the readers really get a clear idea of what's going on. For example, he works in the... His main job in the monastery is winding the clock. Now, I haven't even talked very much about the clock, but it's a big part of the book, the first part of the book, and later on as well. It comes back into it a few times. But Erasmus, he's part of a team of four guys, young guys, who wind the clock. And Jezri is the clever one, and Leo is the fighter, the kind of leader guy as well. He's all into his martial arts. You've got the Arcibolt, I think it's what his name is, I can't be bothered to look it up here. He's sort of like the bumbling guy who might not be very clever, but he's got lots of good intentions, and he's all about, you know, reconciling religion and secular thought, and the intellectual world inside the maths and the religious world outside the maths. That's what he wants to get them talking and a dialogue going on there as well. And Erasmus is just the guy who's sort of tagging along, like not quite sure what he's doing there. He's like the muscly guy, and it's a bit strange. You think, what does he actually have to do in this book? And you realize he doesn't actually have a lot to do anyway, because when things start happening, because he doesn't have a direction in life. Like these other guys, I say, they have a direction. Your Jezri is going to become the intellectual. Leo is going to do this. Asibot's going to do that. And Erasmus is going to do... And actually, that's one of the conjures that he has at the beginning of the book. It's like, I'm not quite sure what my role is. What am I meant to be doing here? Later on in the book, he does get a role. But when shit starts going down, when shit gets real, when the aliens turn up, everyone else is sort of like their plans and their lives are all turned upside down. But because he doesn't have too much of a direction, his life doesn't seem to be turned upside down in the same way as the others, which is a bit strange, because the conflict that he has seemed a little bit manufactured. It's like, no, I've got to do something. What shall I do? It's like, don't worry about it. You'll work something out. But, you know, so it's a bit strange in that way. So it's a little bit dry as well, which I'm not quite sure. His character. And also there is this love subplot which suddenly pops up from nowhere, and I'm like, whoa, wait a second, what happened then? And suddenly he's in love, and I'm like, whoa, and that sort of is a factor throughout the book, and I'm like, well, that was a bit strange. I couldn't, until they sort of fell in love, until they were like, oh, I love you, oh, I love you, I couldn't even remember coming across the girl's name beforehand. I mean, it was there, I'm sure, but for me it was such an insignificant role. But then I'm thinking, wait a second, maybe it's because he's an unreliable narrator that he didn't talk too much about it, because it's sort of like, I hate you. Yeah, but you're only 12-year-old, so of course, or 9 years old, so of course you hate each other. And then later on, when you're 17, you don't want to write about your crushes on girls too much. And that is, of course, he does write about that quite a bit, that like the females in the book seem to have, you know, they're all emotional and just know exactly what's going on with each other, and they can look at each other, have conversations with a glance, and others can't, you know, and the guys are just like, what's going on, I don't understand. So maybe he's actually saying, oh, I don't understand love and I don't understand relationships, and that's why I didn't write about them, until suddenly I was head over heels in love, which again, maybe that's the reason why it's done there, but I'm not quite sure. But then what happens is that we read about these other characters, and the other characters, they seems to be, you know, a lot of the historical characters, they seem to, you know, reflect quite a lot to say about, I mentioned this before, like they have parallels with earthly philosophers and scientists and things like that. Again, some of them you pick out, some of them you don't. But then the characters in the real world, you see them, they seem to be very much a bit too stereotypical. And then in the way that this book blew my mind in many other ways, I was thinking, wait a second, maybe these aren't stereotypical, maybe they're archetypal. And again, I don't want to go too much into it because it might spoil the book too much. But then thinking, wait a second, the concepts laid out in this book are deep enough that archetypal characters would make sense. And there's something explained in the third calca, like the third appendix later on in the book, which they're talking about. Let me just quickly look up the title of it. So it's configuration space. What was the other appendix? It was complex protism. Complex protism with Hylian theoretical worlds and the directive acyclic graph pointing towards the Arban causal domain. And he's introduced so many of these different concepts by the end of the book that I'm thinking, wait a second, we've got this guy's just an archetype, he's a stereotype, he's one dimensional. And then as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, wait a second, maybe once again I'm reading too much into this book, but there's so many levels of this book, and maybe I'm just grasping it. Maybe I'm grasping for straws here and giving excuses for Neal Stephenson's lack of character development or lack of character depth in that way. But I'm just thinking, maybe, and also maybe these characters are the platonic forms of... in Arbor coming through, and that's what we're, and it, I don't want to give too much away here, but I wouldn't say there's an excuse, but there is a reason for perfect love, which passes all understanding and is like a fairy tale love. There is a reason why that can make sense by the end of this book. And when you read the last line of this book, before you get to the appendix and stuff like that, it goes, The end of the book is like, you might find it odd that a story like this one ends with a kiss, as if it were a popular spiele, a popular film, or a comedy acted out on stage. And that end of the book, it really does make sense to, you can tie it back in, just the end of the book, that it ends with a fairy tale wedding between two characters. You think about it and you go, well, again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it makes sense. It can make sense in this book. And again, mind a little bit blown. Okay, so that'll do for the characters. Moving on, science and technology. Wow, this is going to be a long podcast. Science and technology. Well, I'll skip over bits and pieces here. You get the idea that there used to be great hints of technology in the past, and only some of it has been brought forward past the terrible events and past the various sacks of the consents and things like that. And there is... technology that's been stored and technology that's been hidden and ideas that have been hidden, and they're only brought out in times of emergency, like there is, say, an alien invasion is a times of emergency. So there is new technology brought into this book. But one thing that I really enjoyed was what the people inside the Mathic consents wear. They wear the bolt, the cord, and the ball. Now, the bolt is a kind of fabric which stretches, and they can make it thicker and thinner and longer and short, and they can make it blow it up, and it has different properties. And they have the cord, which is like a rope, which grows and shrinks and gets thicker and thinner and things like that. And the ball, which is like a hollow ball, which they can grow and morph into different shapes, and it can be big and it can be small, and they can use it to sit on, and they can then stick it in their pocket. And it's a different kind of... It's like a smart matter and things like that, which is actually really good fun. And when I was first reading it, again, I was just thinking, wait a second, this is just flavor. Oh, this is interesting. This is old technology. But later on, of course, in the book, big technical ramifications, big plot ramifications later on as well. There's the inside the consent, they have technology which is all sort of like clockwork. Like there is actually a clock, so everything is driven by this clockwork. And as I said, every day Erasmus and his team wind the clock, and everything is powered from the clock. And the first 200 pages of the book, there's a lot of explanation of this level of technology and what's going on there, and the way that the gates open and close. And you've got the observatory, the Starhenge, I think it's called, on the top of the roof of this massive monastery as well. And I actually do find all of that really, really interesting. Later on in the book, you get these long technical explanations of how they cross the glacier, and later on how they do this and how they go into space and this and that and this and that. And it's all quite good. But again, there's not actually a lot of point going into it in this book, because there's a lot of point getting into it, but I don't have a lot of time in this podcast, let me put it that way. But let's just say, lots of good inventions. Every bolt and screw is there for a reason. It's pure hard science fiction in one of the best ways, that everything is thought out. And like I say, everything is thought out from first principles. So I'll just leave it at that. Other writing style kind of things, like the action is good. Not everything is always clear and stuff like that, but you know, Neal Stephenson can do action pretty well. Getting on more to the language kind of part of it here, Now, again, I made a note of this as I was going. One of the main characters, Arolo, who is like the main teacher in the beginning of the book, in the first part of the book there, he says, oh, you have to be inside the consent, to be inside the mathic world, to be non-secular kind of person. He says, you have to have attention surplus disorder, not attention deficit disorder, attention surplus disorder. And pretty much that's what you've got to have to read this book. And Neal Stephenson is obviously saying, okay, to be the kind of person who reads this book, you've got to be the kind of person who would get by well inside this consent. Now, I hope that listeners to this podcast are of that kind of level that they are interested in this. And if you're not interested in really putting some thought into it and actually having to have attention surplus disorder, you might struggle with this book a lot. Now, again, as I said before, I heard lots of complaints about the language in this book. You know, when people, again, I listen to other podcasts and they've mentioned it, you know, oh, they make up too many words. And again, looking at the one-star reviews, oh, there's too many made-up words. And he just made stuff up and he's talked about this. And again, there wasn't any... Actually, there was one time. I'll talk about it in a second. But, you know, you've got... It's a slow going... I mean, of course, in the first page, there's lots of explanation. You know, there's lots of new words that are thrown in there and explanations and stuff like that. But if you just go with it, you pick it up quite easily. For example, they have these dictionary insertions as well. It says extramuros in Old Earth, literally outside the wall. So you just, okay, extramuros. You know straight away that you're going to get into this thing, and there's going to be dictionary definitions of things sprinkled in between the chapters and the sections and stuff like that. And you very quickly, okay, Fra Arolo is like in the first sentence, Fra Arolo, an artisan fleck. So you immediately understand that someone who's an artisan, yeah, he's a workman. And a Fra, well, what's a Fra? And you work it out by about the third paragraph, what a Fra is, you know. And you go on and you work it out very easily. It's not that difficult. Really, it's not that difficult. One of the first, one of the one-star reviews that I read, they're complaining of the language. And he says, I almost threw the book against the wall. But he spelt through, not T-H, I can't even say it. I'm going to take the piss out of someone for not being able to spell something and I mispronounce a letter. So yeah, it writes through as in through. He wrote it as in through, as in you go through a door, rather than I threw the book against the wall. And I'm thinking, well, if you can't even grasp English at that level, this really isn't the book for you. However, the language does make sense. It is consistent, and it does play in a lot to it. I mean, there's lots of concepts that he talks about which have to make sense in this world and not in our world, because that isn't our world. And the only way to do that, unlike what the guys did in Nightfall, where they just went, oh, well, it's not really a car, but we'll call it a car. And in this book, they go, no, well, it's not really a car, but we can't call it a car because it has different features and a different background and a different history to a car. So we're going to call it a mob, as in something that's mobile. And we're not going to call a film a movie. We'll call it a spiele for some reason, and a gjar. And there's all these other things. And it got to the point that I couldn't work out if a word that I read in this book was actually a real word, that if I could look up in an English dictionary, I'd be able to find out what it was, or if it was a word of a creation of Stevenson, which made so much sense, made so much perfect sense in his book that it just becomes a word. It's like the word avowt. I'm thinking, you know, by the time I read like 20 pages into this book, I was like, is avowt a real word or not? And then I was sort of like, you know, one second, I just type it in here and one second, avowt. No, it doesn't look at about. Look up in dictionary. No, it's not. You know, my MacBook spell checker doesn't know avowt, so it is a play on the word devout, but it just makes so much sense, because he couldn't say they were monks because they're not monks, and he couldn't say that they were and these other things because that's not what they are. They are something different. He can't just call them professors because they're not professors. They were different things, so he called them a different thing. And I think that's very important, that you can just make up words, make up new concepts, and make up the words to go with them, and it works very, very well in this book. There was one point where I got mixed up. It's because there was these different factions, and one of them called Procyon, and one of them called Proton, and one of them are the followers of Prot. of Proc, and the other I'm getting mixed up now, and the other ones are followers of Protest, and the other ones are followers of Proc, and they actually believe different things, or they view the world in opposite ways, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, that's interesting, but I got a little bit mixed up at that one point, but otherwise I never looked at the timeline at the front of the book until I thought, well, I'll skim it now in preparation for doing this review, and I'd never looked at the glossary at the back of the book once. I didn't need to, because you don't need to. But there you go. So let me go on as well. Oh yeah, passages in the dictionary. I just mentioned them. I really enjoyed this because what he'll do, like I said just before, he says extramuros as the opening little dictionary definition to open up the book, and then a few pages later we get that drop that's just dropped in there, and it's actually a really nice game to play every time he introduces something. Let me just flick backwards and see if I can find another one of these dictionary definitions. Here he goes. Garden steelyard, and I'm like, a rule of thumb attributed to Friar Garden, and it's like he just mentions that, and he pretty much explains that the steelyard is Occam's razor, pretty much. As Lisa, yeah, let me just make sure. Yeah, that is the steelyard, because there's a rake, there's a razor, you know, there's also somebody's rake, which is a different thing as well. And it just, he just says that, and then later on you read about someone, and someone just mentions, oh, steelyard doesn't you can't keep that in the steelyard, or whatever the expression is, and I'm just like, oh, that makes sense. But it's like a game every time it's like chapter titles, you know, when you read a chapter title, if there's a clever chapter title, you think, well, what does that mean? And here you got the chapter titles and the different, you know, and these little dictionary definitions, and you're like, oh, I wonder why he's told us that word. And then, like, a few pages later, you're like, ah. Yet, this whole thing is reflected in the book as a whole, because all of the different descriptions and all of the setting up of the new language and all of the world building that takes place at the beginning, and the dialogues and the conversations and the technology that's laid out and the themes, and, you know, and even he says there's these things called the calcus, and there's actually a dictionary definition which says here's what a calcar is, and I'm like, well, what was a calcar? And he says a calcar is sometime when in a dialogue someone will put an asterisk there, and then he'll say, okay, this is an important thing, but it'll interrupt the flow of the story, I'll interrupt the flow of the dialogue for me to explain this interesting and complex point now, so what I'll do, I'll put it in an appendix at the back and you can read it in your own time, and then come back to this story, and then, you know, reread it and pick it up, and when we're going like that. And it's like, oh, that's interesting. And then someone says something, oh, I explained this to him, and then at the bottom of it, there's suddenly a calca down at the bottom, and it's like a little asterisk, and it says calca 1. So it's this whole game that you're playing here with the language and with the dictionary definitions and with the calca at the back, and then you go back and read it, and then you go back and it's like, well, that's right, there's absolutely nothing there except exposition, or the, not exposition, except a mathematical way of looking at satellite orbits, and you think, well, that's interesting. And then you go back and it informs the little plot that's going on there. And then 800 pages later, suddenly there's this whole thing, and they're in space, and they're needing to know satellite. Well, not they need to know orbital mechanics and navigation and zero gravity movement in space. And I'm like, what is, that's great. We had that there before, and I went on this whole journey, and it was all there. And so all the different kind of stuff that you're thinking, well, this is long, this is a bit boring, you know. And that's what people say. Oh, there's nothing in the first 250 pages. You know, the story doesn't get going. It's like, I said before, are we reading the same book here? Everything in the first 250 pages is reflected later on. Well, not everything, but there are, you know, a few red herrings, but pretty much everything that goes on there as well. So yeah. It is, you know, you just think, oh, I wonder what that is, and then you think, oh, I wonder why we needed that, but it will come up later on. And again, that kind of construction of the book, again, mind a little bit blown, but at the same time, as you get all these different words and technical explanations and things like that, it is written from the point of view of a 19-year-old, so a lot of the writing is basic, the words and the concepts are big words and huge concepts, but a lot of time the language is informal, of course, and when it's not informal, they go pretty much, okay, we're going to have a dialogue now. Are we in a dialogue? Okay, we're in a dialogue. And it goes all formal, and it's just pure dialogue, but it is a dialogue, as in a dialogue, rather than just dialogue. So you don't mind that it's exposition, and you don't mind that it's, as you well know, Captain, and all that kind of stuff going on. It does actually make sense, because that's what the dialogue is for. It's there as a teaching tool to the people there. And even if they know it, even if the two people who are talking, they both know the situation, if that is the case, then it'll be a different kind of dialogue, and they'll be having a battle, or it'll be a different kind of dialogue, and they're going on a, you know, on a journey or a walk, or they're trying to get their mind straight or something like that. So it's a bit strange. But saying that, the tone is sometimes a bit strange. I'm thinking, okay, Erasmus has spent 10 years in the monastery, and all of his intellectual development and all of his education has gone on there. So I'd have thought that it would have had a slightly more formal writing style. And Erasmus sometimes seemed, his voice was sometimes a little bit young and hip. But in a way, I'm quite pleased with that. Because if we would have had all of this stuff, and then a very stern, staid, terse writing style throughout, as you might expect from a priest in a monastery or something like that, who's writing in Latin or some, you know, that kind of thing, it would have been maybe a little bit too much to get through, I think. So in a way, I was actually quite glad that a lot of the time the writing was quite light and the tone was quite light, just as a little bit of balance there. So that was actually quite good as well. Moving on, final section. Wow, I've been going an hour already, but I will get through these themes. I knew this would be a long podcast because, like I say, it is a 1,000-word book. So let's go into it now. The themes. A lot of themes. A lot of themes. I don't even know where to start. You've got impact of technology on the society, the whole setup of the world there with the consents and the avowed being separated from there as well. You know, I could talk a lot about that, and the role of academics and stuff like that. There's a huge thematic thing going on here. I just talked about the language and the meaning of words and the ideas behind words and what they actually mean. Lots and lots of philosophy in here as well. And I really enjoyed the whole play on the different take on... Well, maybe I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, the whole history of philosophy thing going on there as well. What I did enjoy, actually, was one thing that he teased out of this book was the whole quantum physics thing. And they talk about a bit about the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. And that's always a time when I look at it in science fiction, I'm always a bit, because sometimes you think, wait a second, you're going to just go, well, this is happening in this world, and we're going to do this, and then it's going to be in that world, and I'm going to choose this to happen. Sometimes it's a little bit of a shortcut. Thankfully, he skirted the edge of that in this novel and was a lot cleverer with it than I've seen so many other people. For example, in the novel Hominids, which I read almost exactly a year ago. I think it was one of the last books that I reviewed last year. And at the end of the book, they're just like, oh yeah, I read about it on Google. Quantum tubules in the brain. That's what it is. And all the other people go, oh yeah, that must be what it is. Oh yeah, that's what it is. Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, okay, that's great. And I was like, oh, that was a bit of a cop-out, wasn't it? Whereas in this book, you do have... There is a talk about the quantum nature of the brain and how the brain is a complex quantum entangled thing, and it can hold many different states and then coalesce into different thoughts. Now, this worked actually very well as a thematic kind of thing, the idea of upsight, which is like insight, but not... It's not insight, because the whole proton world view, the whole the whole Plato thing, like there's a whole world, there's a whole other realm of ideas out there, and we're just glimpsing it there. So it's like we're getting an insight to this thing, but they're saying, oh yes, but it's in another world, you know, it's in a different dimension, that this is like in a more perfect existence, and we're getting upsight, so we get a glimpse into that. So it's that. That kind of thing is tied together with the different states in a way that I'm not sure is new, and I'm not sure if I've read this before or come across it. It's certainly the first time I've seen it laid out in science fiction in this way, the way that someone can suddenly go click and they have that single thought and it just comes out of nowhere, this invention or revelation or solution to a problem. And that is explored very, very well in this book in a very layered way as well. You could just go, oh well, that's what it is, and it's just like, oh, this is what happens in the great world. And it's like, yeah, but doesn't it happen in the great world? It happens in the individual world. But doesn't it happen in the individual world? It happens in like the subatomic world and on the molecular world and on this different way. And he plays around with it very much so. While I'm not entirely convinced that that the brain is a quantum device. The human brain, human consciousness is a quantum device, because I'm thinking, you know, many quantum things, they're unpredictable individually, but taken as much, the unpredictability of a quantum system is given enough quantum events, the predictability is predictable. What am I trying to say? The randomness is predictable. And I think that there's enough going on in the brain, so even while individual atomic interactions between electrons in the brain is in the individual sparks, maybe quantum events. I think, I mean, this is me totally as a layman talking here, but I think there's enough going on in the brain that the system, that it's that the consciousness and human thought and thought in general takes place at a not such a low level. It takes place at a higher level, that the quantum events add up into a very predictable, the random quantum events add up to a very predictable model, which could be what am I trying to say? Which could be my mind's gone blank now. I need an upside here. Yes, which could be equally easily modeled, or not easily, but perfectly modeled on a computer system, completely deterministic computer system. So that's what I'm thinking. But maybe that I just had an upside there, and actually the thought coalesced. Maybe all I needed to work out was that one brain cell in my mind, and I have actually read this, or I can't remember, I've heard it on a podcast or something, but the idea is that there is actually an event. If you're trying to think of someone's face, or you're trying to think of someone's name, and you're thinking, and they've actually put people under MRI scans, magnetic resonance imaging scans, or whatever it is, and it worked out that it can be a single firing of a neuron is all it takes for you to be not remembering someone's name, and then remembering someone's name. And I'm thinking, okay, so maybe that is the quantum event, which does all this kind of stuff. And there's this whole kind of stuff going on there. And I'm thinking, wait a second. When you actually spend a whole book talking about this theme, and you spend, like, you have many dialogues going on, I actually quite like the idea of the brain as a quantum device. Whereas in hominids, it just goes, oh yeah, I looked it up on Google. And that'll explain the whole plot. I just looked up on Google. Whereas in this book, you have hundreds of pages almost dedicated to this idea. I mean, of course, there's other stuff going on at that same time, but there it is as well. Moving on, I made a note of this as well. I talked about the themes is like you've got like the development of thought in our world, but it's rehashed, it's redressed in this secondary world of the Anathem world, if you put it that way as well. So, of course, back in the day, I said before, you got Thelonese. I'll just read out. Let me go to the glossary here and read out who Thelonese was in this book. Let me quickly find it. Oh, man, I can't find it. I should have put bookmarks in here. Let me check it. A great theor of the golden age of Ethras, protagonist of many dialogues, mentor of Protas, executed by the Ethran authorities for irreligious, or at least disrespectful, teachings. And I'm thinking, well, okay, mentor to Protas is Plato, age of Ethras is Greek, protagonist of many dialogues, you know, okay, executed. I'm thinking, well, okay, that's Socrates. So what he does is, instead of just saying, oh, okay, Socrates would have thought this, He doesn't have that shortcut. So when he's talking philosophy, every time he mentions a school of thought, Neal Stephenson has to explain it in such a way that even if you didn't know the history of philosophy of Earth, you would still be able to come to the same points of view, or still be able to understand the same points of view as not just one or two, but loads and loads of different philosophers through Earth's history. But he's taken away his own shortcut. And that's why so many of the ways that he's talking, so many of the different ideas, come across in a very fresh and interesting way. So you're not just going, oh yeah, I know this. This is just Pythagoras. Well, actually, Pythagoras is quite an obvious example, because they just go, it's the Advocronus theorem or whatever it is, instead of the Pythagoras theorem. You're like, okay, I know this one as well. But, you know, when he says about the... he goes, that's the Steelyard. What's the Steelyard? Well, you've got to think about the Steelyard a bit. And it is the same as Occam's razor, but slightly different. They use it in a slightly different way. They just have a different take on it. So you think about it in a different way. And you've got the rake which is interesting. You've got these other things that, because, like you say, there's no shortcut. He doesn't have the shortcut to just for you to just dismiss it and go, oh, I know what that means. He makes you think about it and all the time. And, you know, you can't just sum it up by just a word. Oh, this is what Kant thought. Oh, this is what Gödel thought. Oh, this is what this is. You know, he doesn't just do that. He has to actually explain it in some way. And I'm obviously nowhere near, not even slightly as deeply read as Neal Stephenson, or probably many of his readers as well. So it got to the point where when he was talking about these different things, I was thinking, okay, which philosopher on earth thought about this? Or did they not? Are we treading new ground here? And like I said before, not everything in this book, I mean, a lot of the stuff in this book is recognizable, but there was glimpses and whole sort of ideas that I've not seen before, or I had glimpses of them in a way that I've not seen them before, or they'd been combined with two ideas in a way that I'm not sure. I'm thinking, has this been combined before? And as I think I mentioned early on in this podcast, but I've been going a long time now, it's like certainly haven't seen it in science fiction, and I've certainly not seen philosophy being used to advance character and advance dialogues, and dialogues being used to advance plot and move it forward. Because as I said before, you read something in the first 50 pages and you're thinking, oh, that's interesting but not really relevant, and then it comes up and it's a crucial factor in the last 50 pages of this book. And as I said before, that is what this book is. It's a dialogue between me and, between the characters in the book, between me as the knowledge seeker and Erasmus as the imbecile and Stevenson as the saunt. But to enjoy this book, you really have to be a seeker. You have to be that knowledge seeker. Like the quote was mentioned in regards to Greg Egan's book. Actually, it was Greg Egan's book. He says, it's amazing how some people sit down and read a novel and they're not prepared to sit down with a pen and a piece of paper to get as much out of the novel as they need to. Now, I didn't take any notes. Well, I took a few notes just by turning the corners over in this book as I was reading it as well. But I didn't need that kind of stuff yet. It was an intellectual journey. It was an intellectual exercise. It was a dialogue. It was a Socratic dialogue, in a way, for me to learn new stuff and for me to expand my mind and for me to come across new things. And also, it was really interesting as a world-building thing. Plot-wise, not as interesting as it could have been, but it is definitely a masterwork of science fiction and literature, and like something, as it says on, or probably in many quotes, let's just pick out a quote, he'll probably say something about transcending its Time magazine, whatever happened to the great novel of ideas, it has morphed into science fiction, and Stevenson is its foremost practitioner. That's actually pretty good description. Normally I'm not a big one for quotes on the back of the books, especially if they're not from Publishers Weekly, but this is, here at Chicago Sun-Times, it is in fact the best ever genre-crushing power script that defies simple classification. Maybe not the best ever, but it's certainly genre-crushing and defies classification. But it is, like I say, it is a journey. And if you're not interested in going on a journey of the mind and a journey of the intellect, and also on just a big journey through a new world as well, I'd say stay away. Stay well away. And it's a long book as well. It'll take you, I mean, I've had a lot of time, but it still took me about 2 weeks to read it, I guess. No, maybe 10 days. Yeah, it took me about 10 days to read the book to finish it off. But again, I've had a lot of time on my hands. It is a masterwork. I always said this to Paula, my ex-girlfriend. She's an artist, and she would make these artworks, and she would start off with something small and then take the idea and take it bigger and bigger and bigger until she'll make something huge. And I always said to her, the masterwork is when you create an artwork which is bigger than you are. And, of course, it's difficult. I mean, of course, some books are bigger than the people who write them, but I think that's what he's made here, in a more metaphorical space sense. He's made a book which is bigger than he is, not physically, but as I said, metaphorically. And I know that I'm going to be thinking about this book for a long, long time. It's a long book, and I only finished it a few days ago, but I'm still thinking, oh, that's amazing. And even just in the way that I've been talking about this book now, as I've been talking about it, I've been coming up with ideas, I've been dropping them some of them into this podcast review. But it is amazing. And when I put the novel down, even after the sort of the weakish ending, I'm still thinking, this is easily the best novel,
probably the best novel that I've read this year. Thinking back now, off the top of my head, other novels, actually, I'll just bring up the list here on iTunes, because I've got all the podcast listed here in my iTunes. But yeah, we've got Hyperion. I remember enjoying that, but it sort of tailed off towards the end. Left Hand of Darkness, also really enjoyed that. There's two high points, just throwing them out there from this year. But otherwise, this novel is, I think, definitely a high point of my science fiction reading this year. I found it quite amazing. So I'm going to call it, because I'm going to give it 4.5. No, it's not 5-star books, because I did have problems with it. And there's... maybe if I read it again, but the thing is, it's too long to read again for me to get more out of it. But I think if I did read it again, it might become a 5-star book, or it might become a 4-star book, depending on which way it goes. So for now I'm going to call it a 4.9-star book, which is big, and maybe it's surprising there, but I got a lot out of this book. And even after reading some 1-star reviews, there is things wrong with it, but as I said, all I do with this, with my rating, is how much I enjoyed the book. And while this wasn't quite perfect enough for me to give it 5 stars, it certainly was. It's a great enough book. It's an impressive enough book. It's a big enough feat for me just to be so impressed by reading it. And also, in a way, quite pleased with myself that I got through it and got so much out of it, and seem to have probably got more out of it than most people. Well, maybe not. I can't say that, but judging from other people's reviews of this book, other people's comments about the book, oh, it's a slog, oh, nothing happens for the first 200 pages, then I got so much out of the first 200 pages, I think is a good thing. Is a good thing about my own take on science fiction. Maybe I'm inflating my own ego up too much here, but I'm just saying I got a lot out of the book. Anyway, next book that I'm going to read, it's not going to be science fiction. I picked this up in Borders as well, in Miami. It's Brandon Sanderson, Elantris. It's a fantasy book. But after this, I'll do a speculative fiction book review podcast episode, where I'll go back over the 6 or 7 different fantasy novels that I've read this year and sum them up, hopefully in about 10 minutes each, or go over them part by part, or I'll work out some way of doing it, which sounds interesting as well, like that. And maybe in the new year, I'll just, instead of only reviewing science fiction novels, if I do read more fantasy books, I'll just do a normal review in the same way that I do as a science fiction book. Maybe we'll see how it goes. And after that, I'm out of paper novels. The only book that I have there is then the Bible. So I'll see what's on my iPhone. I'll probably go for The Invisible Man, H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man, partly because Jesse is going to be reading it or listening to it as well on the science fiction, on the SFF audio podcast, and we might have a discussion about it there as well. So I'll see how it goes. Otherwise, you can keep track of my future reads or my current readings as well on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. You can follow me on there, or just become my friend, or just see what I do. I'm not quite sure how it all works there, but you can work it out. Otherwise, email me if you've got anything to say about this review. Sorry that it's gone on so long, but again, there's sometimes that you just got to take your time to talk about a book like this, and I could have gone on longer. But if you've got anything to add, or you've got anything to complain about, or if you've got anything to mention, email me luke@juggler.net. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. And also, you can follow my blog, where I'm going to be posting a little bit more about my reading and about my writing as well, because I've been concentrating a little bit more on photography. I've been posting at least 1 or 2 photos per day upon my blog recently, while I've been traveling and taking lots of photographs, and I'll keep doing that. But I'm going to be posting a bit more about my reading and writing coming up in the next few weeks as well, and a lot of other topics that I've been thinking about recently and want to write about too. Otherwise, keep an eye out for my next novel that I'm going to be releasing, hopefully, in the next few weeks. I sent out emails to previous people who read my other novels and given me feedback. I sent out to about 20 people saying, hey, who wants to read my next novel and give feedback? And within about 15 minutes, 6 people have replied saying, hey, yeah, send me your novel. So that actually makes me feel quite good. And now 10 people want to read it and give feedback. So I'm quite inspired by that. Like I say, I've got about 1,000 words left of that to write, but I should be sending it out probably tomorrow or the next day to my first readers. And hopefully in a few weeks' time, I'll put it out. And that's a follow-up to my first novel, Minding Tomorrow, which you can read on my website. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening. It's been a long one. I hope you've had a good journey. I hope you've... Hope you're thinking about reading Anathem, because, it's a good book. And I'll catch you next time.